Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. 180 million Americans take prescription drugs every day to regulate their blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol. 70% of Americans are overweight. 35% have diabetes, and 50% will get cancer in their lifetime. Could the answer to our health crisis be found in the produce section? Joining us today is world-renowned scientist Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He's going to be sharing how a whole food plant-based diet is the key to preventing and even reversing disease. Don't go anywhere. It all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest received his master's degree and PhD in nutrition, biochemistry, and toxicology from Cornell University. For over 40 years, he's been at the forefront of plant-based nutrition research. He's also authored over 300 research papers, and his best-selling book, The China Study, is considered by many to be the most comprehensive study of health and nutrition ever conducted. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Whole, and The Low-Carb Fraud. He's been featured in several documentaries, including Forks Over Knives, Eating You Alive, Food Matters, and Plant Pure Nation. Here to share how degenerative diseases can be prevented and even reversed by eating a whole food plant-based diet. Welcome back to the show, Dr. T. Colin Campbell.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
You are truly the pioneer when it comes to research on eating a whole food plant-based diet. You must be cringing when you see these popular paleo and keto diet fads promoting high animal consumption. What health consequences does a diet high in animal foods lead to?
All sorts of consequences. I'd like to answer it in reference to the science. If you just simply examine the relationship between animal protein and diseases like heart disease and cancer, the linear relationship is just it's perfect almost. I mean, the higher the consumption of animal protein-based foods, animal foods that is, the higher is the risk for those diseases. That's one perspective on it.
Right.
It's very impressive.
Yeah, and you know what I find interesting is you grew up on a dairy farm and drinking milk was considered a normal part of life for you, and now you're one of the dairy industry's public enemy number one. Was there a specific aha moment when you realized the health risks associated with dairy consumption?
I don't know whether it's a specific time. I mean, I was doing work in the Philippines, as you may know, and I had an observation that I thought was kind of weird, high protein, high cancer, if you will. So we came back and organized an experimental program at the university where I was at the time, and that continued. And so we basically saw the same thing when we did that work in the laboratory. As you increase animal protein, and especially of all things, the protein, the main protein, cow's milk, it really increased the rate of growth of cancer. It was very dramatic. It was, you know, something that you have to do a few times to believe it. But there it was.
Right.
And we could turn cancer on and off. We could turn the development of cancer on and off by that. And when I got to that point, I said, wow, I get serious about this. Because
right.
Then we gradually morphed into other kinds of research, including human studies. And we looked at it many, many different ways, other nutrients, too. And when, you know, all was said and done, I mean, I just have to say, the ability of nutrition, I call it, the ability of nutrition to solve health problems, either maintaining health or preventing and actually reversing disease. I mean, there's nothing like it in medicine.
Right. You know, when I tell patients to get off milk, many of them give me this glazed look like I told them they should get off oxygen. And their biggest concern is, how are they going to get the calcium their body needs and the protein their muscles need without milk? And I'm sure you hear that all the time. How do you respond?
Well, for one thing, the standards that are set for people to pay attention to, if you will, are set too high. And sort of impresses people that need more of, let's say, calcium and protein, since you mentioned those two. That's just one thing. There's also a very interesting history on the protein question. Ever since it was discovered way back in 1839, it was considered the stuff of life itself, according to some researchers at that time. And so it went through the years. I mean, there's something about animal protein as a nutrient. It's almost like a cultish kind of attitude. We just came to believe that if you didn't have animal protein, you know, at the center of your plate, something was wrong. You're going to suffer. And that has been so much a part of our history and our discussion for all these years. And so I say, we don't need animal protein. We get all the protein we need from plants.
Right. And also
calcium we do too.
Yeah. And people always say, you know, they need milk for calcium, but where do cows get their calcium? From plants. So why not go to the source? Cut out the middleman.
Exactly. Exactly right.
That's great. You know, what's funny is that a lot of people, they believe, you know, they understand, oh, there's some bad with milk, and they believe that milk's okay as long as it's organic and from grass-fed cows and it's fat-free. Share why this has no bearing on improving the health benefits of dairy.
I missed the last part of the question.
Yeah, a lot of people, they choose the fat-free and they say it's okay, or lactose-free, or grass-fed. Yeah,
sure.
Why are those insignificant?
Well, for one thing, you know, we did go through quite a number of years believing that the problem with dairy, if you will, and meat too, was the fact that it had all that fat. And it can be an issue, but when we then switched to skim milk, you know, just the milk that is without any fat in it,
mm-hmm.
the only thing left behind really is protein. And that is, if anything, is worse. So the fat is the amount of fat, the kind of fat, that can play a role, yes. But in terms of whole food, plant-based diet, it's really the protein, the animal protein in particular, that tends to set the stage for disease, if you will.
Yeah, I know the casein in milk is the protein we need to watch out for. And as you just mentioned, so if it's fat-free, there's more casein, which means it's even worse, which people don't realize.
That's
they can't
right.
wrap their head. Yeah, so that's a great point to bring up. I know in the China study, you examined mortality rates and diets and lifestyles and found those that ate high consumption of animal-based foods were more likely to get chronic diseases than those with plant-based diet. In your opinion, are all animal foods equal offenders? Or are there certain diseases more specific to dairy, beef, pork, and chicken eaters?
There's probably some differences here and there, but they're small. They're really kind of insignificant, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the big difference is just simply going from animal food to plant food.
So
even amongst all the plants, we know, too, that some plants are a little more effective here or there or something of that sort, maybe involving this nutrient or that nutrient. I mean, we see some of those kind of changes, maybe, but they're really quite insignificant. And it's really the big picture is simply eating the animal foods versus plant foods.
Right. So even with pescatarians that include just fish in their diet, in your opinion, are they healthier than those that eat the pork, chicken, and beef? Or does anything with a face cause the same health concerns?
There was some evidence over the years to suggest that maybe they're a little better off. But in reality, the protein of fish is virtually the same as the protein of other land-based mammals, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Also, fish doesn't have the antioxidants in it and the complex carbohydrates that plants do. So on the nutritional side of the equation, fish is really not anything as any better than the rest of the foods. If you started looking at the relationship between fish consumption and some of the diseases, we did have some evidence over the years that people eating maybe fish from the ocean didn't have quite as high a risk of heart disease as other people. But again, the difference, what to the extent that that's significant, is small.
Right.
So, fish is, in a sense, is the same as the rest.
Same,
of
but it's the least offender if you had to pick, but it's still not good in your opinion. I got you.
Yeah, exactly.
I got you. Now, I know cancer, it's at an all-time high in opinions on what causes the disease vary, and you did some eye-opening research, and you showed how dormant cancer cells come alive in response to certain foods that are eaten. Share with us this intriguing discovery, because that's kind of, you can't get more proof than that.
Well, the model we had in that case was an experimental situation. The model we had is one where you start the cancer by the consumption of the chemical carcinogen, okay, which in turn causes a mutation. So it's generally accepted that all cancers really start with mutations, okay? And that leads to the presumption, as for many, many years and still today, it's the presumption that you can't reverse cancer because mutations don't reverse. This is the sum of substance of it. In reality, what we found, this is many years ago now, we did it many different ways. That's not true. In other words, just adjusting the level of protein, adjust the level of protein, could turn the cancer process on or turn it off. And very quickly, very quickly. And what we used in that case was animal protein versus plant protein, if you will, the amount of animal protein. And so, I think that reversal of cancer is a very exciting proposition. I've just written a more up-to-date review on that, just recently published, quite a long paper, but I'm basically going in and making the argument on the basis of the biochemical evidence that we produce and others have had.
Right.
And it's really quite spectacular. I'm very excited about this idea. The cancer is not a genetic disease, as the cancer people like to say. It's actually a nutritional disease.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think that everything's pointing to that now. And then let me ask you a question. Yeah. Since you had the one thing I want to bring up is these whole grains, you know, used to be considered healthy and help lower blood sugar. Now we got these anti-grain advocates telling us stay clear of them because they spike our blood sugar and they create inflammation. What's your take on the latest anti-grain diet trend?
Well, if you look at the literature that's being published on that, especially the books, if you will, it turns out these folks are really opposed to anything I say or Dr. Bernard says and others. They're really opposed to this whole philosophy. And so I think they're using the argument involving the grains just to try to discredit a much larger truth. And they'll pick out a couple of things. For example, gluten, which is in grains. I mean, yes, gluten sensitivity does occur in people, but not near to the extent that they would like to pretend. And then there's another sort of idea, too. Gluten belongs to a class of chemicals called lectins. And there's a recent book out on that, that grains have these lectins. And they're bad, and this and that. And so it's not just gluten. There's a lot of other lectins, which is kind of a smear against all the grains, if you will, the whole grains. And again, it's the same thing. This fellow actually referred to my work and Dr. Esterton, and he really has a strong bias against what we do. In fact, in that particular case, the guy has no training in nutrition, has done never done any research on the question. So I have to say it's a fraud.
Yeah,
it's a fraud. As I said, gluten sensitivity is an issue, yes, but that needs to be discovered and diagnosed and treated accordingly. But the number of people who have that problem is very small compared to, you know, claiming it's a big, big problem.
Right. And, you know, I would just talk to Dr. Bernard before you, and we were talking about how these paleo folks are saying we didn't have grains till 10,000 years ago, but scientific evidence shows in our cavemen 3.5 million years ago, there's grain in their teeth. There's even gluten in their teeth. So we've had millions of years to be able to process and break this down. I think there's a bigger picture for those that are sensitive. I don't think we can blame the food. I think we can really blame the pesticides, these chemicals, and making some people sensitive to it. But, you know, to eradicate and say, oh, get off all grains, I agree. I think that's a big, big, big overkill, and maybe it is going up against you in some of these plant-based docs, but it makes no sense. Common sense or common science doesn't tell me to stay off grains. So that's great that you cleared that up. Now, when you were on the show last time, you shared something that was really profound. You told me 80% of healthcare costs could be eliminated if people ate a whole food plant-based diet. Yet doctors rarely, they bring up diet with their patients. When are books like the China Study going to be mandatory reading in medical colleges?
Well, I'm actually discovering that it's finally been received fairly well in medical schools. I've spoken to at least 150 medical schools, if you will, and even more medical-sponsored conferences. You know, it took a while, but I'm really meeting a lot of really, really very fine people realizing they never got any training in nutrition. And so they're buying into it. They're really seeing this information for what it is. And a lot of doctors now are actually beginning to, you know, share this with their patients. The problem is that we have now and have had is there's not a medical school in the country that actually teaches nutrition, number one. Number two, of the 130 or so, whatever it is, the medical specialties that we have, which you'll know that, and which is used as a means more or less as a structure for reimbursement. Of those 130 medical specialties, there's not one called nutrition. So the mechanism for getting reimbursed, doctors need to be reimbursed. There's no incentive, really, to go down that pathway talking about nutrition. At least that's my take on it. And so if they're not trained, if these important people are not trained in this area, and then in turn they don't have an opportunity to get reimbursed for it, and then there's a third part of that story, by the way, it's important. The amount of actually serious research done on nutrition has been very poorly supported. The NIH, who actually supports the major biomedical research agency in the world, they funded almost all of my research. The NIH has 28 institutes, that's plural, of different diseases and so forth and so on. There's not one institute called the Institute of Nutrition. Right. And so you take that triumvirate, you know, no training, no opportunity for reimbursement, really. And no research, no serious research, just focus directly on, you know, what nutrition can do or what it can't do. That's a terrible recipe to, you know, for trying to convey this information to the public.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you mentioned something that I do in my book as well. You follow the money. It's really money dictates on what you recommend. And I've never been to a pharmacy where I watched the person say, do we want me to get the pharmacist to explain to you the side effects of this asparagus you're buying?
That's right. That's a very good story. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we mentioned about it, you know, I asked you about when your book's going to be in medical school. But, you know, I think a lot of this awareness is from patients sharing the books from you and Dr. Bernard and so forth with their medical doctors. After they get better, the doctor says, how is this possible? And they hand them the book. I think that's creating the wow factor. I think it's the advocates of your readers.
You're right. Absolutely. I've heard a lot of stories like that. And as I go around to medical schools now, a surprising number of people have read the book. And are really sort of, you know, quite interested in this subject. Not necessarily haven't studied a lot, but they're certainly interested. So I really see a fairly rapidly growing awareness, in my estimation, in the medical system, in medical school. Very gratifying.
Yeah, I loved
that. The book Whole has been used as a text, but.
Yeah, I know that in your book, Whole, you share a section on government misinformation and how lobbyists and big pharma bury any focus on diet and nutrition in favor of drugs, especially when it comes to cancer. And it's really become condemnation for those suffering with cancer and a celebration for those treating it. And how can people get off the medical hamster wheel? People are hearing this. They're into this medical wheel, this process. What can they do?
Well, I've got another book coming out. I'm really getting into exactly that kind of question. At the individual level, they just need to become aware of this information. And there's lots and lots of books out now for one thing to start things off. We have an online course that actually offers 30 Category 1 CME credits for physicians and equivalent credits for others in the health profession. But in any case, that's really done really well. So there's opportunities to be educated. There's others who have programs somewhat like that too. Books, films, obviously films have a fairly major effect. I think in order to get awareness, you know, amongst the population at large, those three instruments, education, right, filming, books, and try it. The bottom line is actually trying it, and you can see what kind of results that one can get.
Yeah, I know knowledge is power, and just people go, and if you don't have time
to read
a book, there's so many documentaries, you know, everybody's now got Netflix and they're there. So, you know, there's ways, but okay. I think people need to play detective. I think they can't be so trusting that what they're eating is safe. They really need to. It's not like our great-great-grandparents, you know, it's times have changed. So a lot of stuff that people need to start being aware of.
One of the things I became interested in over the years, started some 30 years ago or more, was the history of this field. I got a lot of pushback when I first started talking about this way back in the early 80s and late 70s. And it was very, very serious pushback. And so I got kind of discouraged at times. I mean, this is at the national level, you know, on expert committees and things like that. Then I spent a year at Oxford University in England, surely about that time, 1985, 86. And I just decided to see if there was something in our history, you know, that makes it difficult for people to understand this. And it was, I wrote a big paper. I didn't do anything with it until just more recently. I started to pick it, you know, taking pieces out of it. And I have to tell you, the history of this field really gives great, at least for me, it really helps to explain, you know, why we're in the situation we are now, where nutrition is not a serious medical topic and where so many people don't seem to know about it. And so that's what my next book is about, you know, how politics, economics, and especially, I should say, quite frankly, greed and ego and that sort of thing played a role over the years.
Yeah, we definitely have to.
Nutrition has always been it's been set aside. Nutrition is the forgotten science in medicine, in my view.
Yeah, when that book comes out, you better get back here and we're going to share about that because that sounds very intriguing. And that's kind of like, I think it pulls back the curtain and you're going to reveal Oz is what it sounds like.
You know, my tentative title actually is Behind the Curtain.
Is it really?
Yeah, that's what you just said. I'm not sure I'm keeping it, but yeah, at the moment, that's what it is, behind the curtain.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Yeah, I know when your production with Forks Over Knives, the film came out, it created a massive ripple effect. I mean, that really changed and altered the way we look at food now. And how does that feel, seeing that thing take off so well and all these films come after that?
Well, it's great. It's really nice. I get a little discouraged at times. You know, when some of the discussion around this idea is not as scientific as I'd like to see it be, or others coming along, you know, well, would-be scientists talking about this.
Right.
But So, but set that aside. That's the fact is that this information is getting out there. Yes, it's very gratifying. But the part that I'm really interested in personally is to get some of my colleagues, you know, in the so-called establishment, you know, either in the scientific community or in the more political area, policy area. Those people, you know, a lot of them who are, you know, sort of controlling things, if you will,
right,
they are still reluctant to go here. And so I think the only way that we can really deal with that is to make the argument on the basis of really solid science.
Yeah.
So that's been my sort of
fantastic.
My pathway, do it that way.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure. You bring such great food for thought, and the pun is intended there. For more information or if you want to purchase any of Dr. Campbell's best-selling books, go to nutritionstudies.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out his plant-based diet recipes, videos, articles, and online courses. You can follow Dr. Campbell on Facebook and Instagram at Nutrition Studies and on Twitter, T. Colin Campbell F. And for my daily Facebook and Twitter post, follow me at Dr. David Friedman on Instagram at Health Radio Doc. If you heard Dr. Campbell share something today that would benefit somebody you know, send them a link to this podcast. It's available to yourgoodhealthradio.com. And while you're there, be sure and check out our podcast library and share segments with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. This information is too important to keep to yourself, so share it. You can also subscribe to our future podcasts at iHeartRadio and iTunes. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.